If I should happen to go a little long this morning, we can come back and visit tomorrow. We have to be out by 11:30 this morning. My subject this morning for us is watch. Jesus is coming very soon. He's coming very soon. You know, on December 21st, one of my sons-in-law and I walked the short trail through the brightly moonlit forest to the log cabin overlooking the lake. And it was a gorgeous evening. It was minus 27 degrees cold. The trees were loaded with snow and the moonlight was so bright it made the shadows look dark. The snow looked like it was reflecting light in the moonlight. We lit the lantern in the cabin and stoked the fire in the little pot-bellied heater and drank coffee. The little heater was glowing red, trying to push the cold air out of this minus 27 cabin. Outside was the little lake, and it was just as bright as could be in the moonlight. And it was 10:30 in the evening. Why were we there? That night, for the first time in my life, I would see a blood moon. How many have seen the blood moon? One. It was the first time in nearly 400 years that a blood moon would happen on the shortest day of the year. Many who were aware of this event, I understand, wondered, what will this mean? Maybe Jesus will come now in the blood moon. But we were not there because of the chance of Christ's return being any greater that night than any other night. We were there to witness this event. And shortly after 11:30, precisely as announced, the shadow of the earth began to touch the edge of the moon. And when the earth's shadow covered the moon entirely, the refracted light of the sun turned the moon to blood. It did remind one of the words of Peter in Acts chapter 2, verse 20, "The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before that great and notable day of the Lord." Now, just before he was crucified, in his last great discourse, Jesus shared with his disciples what lay ahead for mankind before he returned at the end of the age. The disciples had asked him three questions. You see, as they walked from the Temple Mount through the valley of the Kidron up the other side of the Mount of the Olives, Jesus had told them a lot of things that were going to happen. This is just before he was crucified. Then they asked him what the sign of his appearing would be, or they asked him, when will all these things be? What will be the sign of your appearing? And what will be the sign of the end of the age? And Jesus patiently answers these three questions in Matthew 24 and 25. These chapters took place during the Passover week, just a few days before he was crucified. And in these two chapters, Jesus opens a large window into the future and says, "Come and look. This is what is yet to come." The verses we are going to look at this morning are Matthew chapter 24, verses 42 through 44. Let me just read those for you. "Watch, therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not expect him." So I want to begin this morning by giving us the context of these verses. In my understanding of these two chapters, Matthew 24 and 25, Jesus answers the disciples three great questions of Matthew 24, 3. The disciples had said to him, "Tell us, when will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming? And what will be the sign of the end of the age?" They wanted to know when the things he had spoken of would happen. Then they wanted to know what the sign of his coming would be and what would be the sign of the end of the age. I understand that as two different questions. His return is called, in the Greek language, his parousia. His parousia literally means his presence. It is this word that is used in Matthew 24:3 as his coming. Vine's dictionary says of this word, when used of the return of Christ at the rapture of the church, it signifies not merely his momentary coming for his saints, but his presence with them from that moment until his revelation and manifestation to the world, which happens at the end of the tribulation. It is my understanding of this Olivet discourse that in verses 42 through 44, we are in the midst of his discussion of his return for the church. Now, some of you may be aware that there are premillennialists, even those who hold to a pre-tribulational return of Christ, that teach that Jesus was not here referring to the rapture. He's referring to his coming at the end of the tribulation. Let me just say this. I am aware of the teaching, and I cannot see it that way. Here is how I see this discourse. I see Matthew 24, 4 through 8, as speaking of what it will be like in the world before the tribulation. You see, this is New Year's Day. I want to challenge us this morning to be ready for his coming at any time. I believe that's what the Bible teaches. So, Matthew 24, 4 through 8, speak of what it will be like before the tribulation, my understanding. I should have given you note sheets this morning, right? Many will say they are Christ. That's what's going to happen, Jesus said. We have seen that for some time already. It's a lot of years ago already. There were 200 in California alone that claimed to be Christ. Furthermore, Jesus said we would hear of wars and rumors of wars, but the end is not yet. Then he prophesied that there will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places. Certainly, we are all aware that we are seeing those things unfold today. Then, beginning in verse 8, he tells them what it will be like in the tribulation, and by verse 15, we are precisely in the middle of the tribulation. Let's read that, 24, verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Whoever reads and understands knows we are now in the middle of the tribulation. By verse 29, the tribulation has come to a close. Look at it. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, now the tribulation has come to a close. Then in verse 32, he says that when we see all these things, we know that it is near. Luke tells us that it is when all these things begin to happen. The aorist tense in the Greek here in Matthew 24 tells us the same thing. And what is the beginning of those things? We have them in the early parts of the chapter. Many will say they are Christ. There will be wars and rumors of wars, pestilences and famines and earthquakes happening and so on. And we are seeing those things today. And what it means is that his presence is very near. That presence, my understanding, begins at the rapture. Then in verses 36 through 39, it tells us Jesus' coming will be like the days of Noah. They were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the flood came and took them all away. This is how it will be when Christ returns. So some preachers preach as if there's something wrong with eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage. It's wrong if you don't marry and give in marriage. What is he trying to say? When Christ comes, it will be life as usual, just like it is now. Not like it will be at the end of the tribulation when they're begging for the rocks and hills to fall on them. It will be like now. No expectation of his coming, and all of a sudden he's there. That's what it would be like. Days of Noah teach us this. So let's read verses 40 through 41. Then two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one will be taken and the other left. This is how it will be when Christ comes for his bride. Again, I understand there are various views, even pre-tribulational teachers who tell us that this refers to the end of the tribulation. I do not think that is possible myself and view it as speaking of when he comes for the church. Now let me draw your attention to the command of the verse found in the text that we had in verse 42. Watch, therefore. Watch. And note the word that follows the word watch. Watch, therefore. Why? Why should we watch? Because we do not know when he is coming. That's why. We don't know when he will come. Two will be in the field, one will be taken, and the other left. Watch, therefore. Why? All of a sudden, somebody's going to be gone. And somebody's going to be left. And the danger is that you might be left. Watch. Therefore. Is this not the message of the ten virgins also? That is why the therefore is therefore. He tells us this in the very next word. It says, watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. Now I ask you, why are we to watch? I have puzzled over this for many, many years. Is it because if we are not looking into the sky at the precise moment he comes, we're going to miss it? Is that why? Have you ever pondered this? Watch. So we have to keep looking up, because if we don't see him at the precise moment he comes, we will be lost. Is that it? I don't think so. If we fail to watch and to be spiritually active and to be waiting for his return, we might drift away. Is that a possibility? We can get caught up with the things of this world and we might get sidetracked and end up being left behind. A warning. Now, how does a person get sidetracked? What's my time like? Go to Matthew chapter 13. How does a person get sidetracked in life? Matthew chapter 13, I'm going to read verses 3 through 9. Then he spoke many things to them in parables, saying, behold, a sower went out to sow, and as he sowed, some seeds fell by the wayside, and the birds came and devoured them. Some fell on stony places where they did not have much earth, and they immediately sprang up because they had no depth of earth. But when the sun was up, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. And some fell among the thorns, and the thorns sprang up and choked them. But others fell on good ground and yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, some 30. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. It is my view, though questioned by others, that in Matthew 13, we have the church age pictured in parables. Here Jesus shows us what it will be like in the age in which we live. This particular parable Jesus interpreted, and from his interpretation, we understand what he intended to be understood. You see, the one who received the word on the hard pathway, picturing a hard heart, is the one who hears it, hears the word, doesn't understand it, and doesn't do anything about it. The devil comes, snatches it away, and it's gone. But the one who receives it in a stony heart, he hears the word, receives it, and is filled with joy. But a little persecution, a few hardships, and he is offended. Offended in God. stumbles and goes down for the count. He wants a Christianity that does not cost. But I want us to look especially at the one who receives the word among the thorns. Look at verse 22. Now he who received the seed among the thorns is he who hears the word, and the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and he becomes unfruitful. In this verse lies the danger we constantly face. Do you remember what Joshua, the Christian from Ethiopia, told us here at the missions conference? You know what he said? If you can live as a Christian in Canada, you can live it anywhere. Here are the things that will sidetrack us. The cares of this world, what are those? What are those? Making a living, work, a house, a car, clothing, food, etc. The cares of this world, not sin, just the cares of this world. And what happens? We get all caught up and absorbed. Am I right? We're talking about legitimate things gone awry. We are immersed in this danger. In Ethiopia, it may not be that dangerous with us. Then our church time is robbed. Our Bible reading is robbed. Our prayer life is robbed. Then we get into non-essentials like sports. Not too many years ago, it was not allowed to do organized sports on Sunday in Canada. Now, we do not even know such laws existed. We don't mind using Sunday for sports. We get robbed. If we expected Jesus any day, we might change our lifestyle. Am I right? What is the danger here? Is it because these things are sin? No. It is because we let these things lull us to sleep. That's why we're to watch. And soon, you see, well, soon spiritual things lose their flavor. I wonder this morning, are you there? This book, not so precious anymore. But the second thing mentioned here is the deceitfulness of riches. Why are riches so deceitful? Because I need just a little more. If I only had so or so much, then I could give time to the kingdom of God. I've told you, I've met about three or four people here in La Crete who have told me that once I get so or so much, I want to go do some short-term mission work. Never got so or so much yet. Just give me a little more time and a little more money and I will have enough. And then I will bear fruit. I would talk to others about Jesus, but I will be able to do a lot more as soon as I have a little more money. The deceitfulness of riches. Oh, how deceiving. Always promising much, but producing so very little. They are so deceitful. And how are riches so deceptive? The word translated riches comes from the word meaning to fill. To fill. It speaks of when something is accomplished or filled. I am rich when this or that is full. When I have enough. And when do I have enough? When it is full. And when is it full? Oh, when I have accomplished this or that. When I have a little more. And we get sidetracked. I am always so glad this church has paid me so I didn't have to work. Because I'd get sidetracked. Did I need that second job? Yeah. For what? So I have a little more. Just a little more. Days eat weeks, and weeks turn into months. Months give way to years, and then I am 40 or 50, and I still need just a little more. Then, when I have a little more, or maybe even before that, I find myself caught by the third hook. Now I am tired, and I want some R&R. It's time to relax. Thank you, Lord, for blessing me, but Lord, I am tired. I need some R&R. I'm gonna go down south, and I'm going to spend my month down south. Now, I'd like to retire, too, but I don't want to go down south. There's a minister over there. Jesus said we needed rest. I just want to have some pleasure now. The Gospel of Mark adds that there is yet one more thing that chokes the believer from becoming fruitful. He says, and the lusts or desires of other things entering in choke the word. You know what happens when the word is choked? We are in danger. Are we not? We are in danger. Luke spells out a little more clearly what this means. He says, it is not only the cares of this life and the deceitfulness of riches, but it is the pleasures of this life as well. The pleasures. The word translated pleasure is hedone. We get several English words from this word, and you may recognize them. The word hedonic comes from or means that which pertains to pleasure. The word hedonism. Are you familiar with this word? Hedonism, not heathenism, it's hedonism. It speaks of a view of life that has pleasure as its main pursuit. I think sometimes today it's okay for Christians to have pleasures as their main pursuit. They can be star hockey players or whatever. The word hedonism speaks of one who views pleasure as the chief goal of life. The pleasure of this life can lead us off the path. Now come with me to this farmer's field of Matthew 13. You see that thorn bush over there? Do you see that pale, shriveled stalk of grain desperately reaching for some moisture, but the thorn's root is already there? This thorn bush, the thorn bush of the cares of this life, doesn't look bad. It got most all the nurture of the wheat stalk, which could never get quite enough. Then, of course, there's the thorn bush of the deceitfulness of riches, just a little more. And if all of those are in place after years of toil have been taken care of, it's time for rest, maybe even before. See that healthy thorn bush and the skinny, pale, small-headed stalk of grain sticking out? That's what parable talks. At the danger we are always immersed in our country. And then we go to church and we sing, work for the night is coming. What is our constant danger? We may forget to watch. Oh, it is not hard to sleep just a little. And then a little more. And then a little more. So the Bible says, watch, watch. So the command given by none other than the Lord Jesus here is that we are to watch. If we fail to be on guard and begin to live unfaithfully, one will be taken and the other left. That's what I understand to be the teaching here. The warning is very solemn. I ask you this morning, are you spiritually active? Is the Bible a living word to you? Do you search it and hunger for His word? Or have the things of earth distracted? Watch. Watch. That's the command here. We are to live in such a way as to expect the Lord at any moment. This is a very huge challenge. Well, the command of this passage is to watch. The reason for that command is because when the Lord comes, the one who is ready will be taken and the one who is not ready will be left. This warning is given because nobody knows when the Lord will come. That is what this passage says. We are to always watch and guard our spiritual life because we do not know when Jesus is coming. Jesus now gives an illustration regarding the fact that we need to be ready at all times because we do not know when He is coming. He said, But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not have allowed his house to be broken into. Now, maybe you say, listen, the Bible teaches that the Lord will come in the middle of the tribulation. I am watching. When I hear of a peace pact made in Israel for 7 years, I will know that it is only 3.5 years until Jesus comes. Are you with me? Maybe I shouldn't be doing this, right? Or you say, the Bible teaches Jesus will come at the end of the tribulation. I will not be caught by surprise. When Israel will make a peace pact for 7 years, I will know it will be 7 years and Jesus will come. I will be ready then. I want you to listen again to the illustration Jesus gives. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. The warning Jesus gives here is that we cannot know when he is coming, is it not? We are not instructed to be on guard someday after this or that happens. You wait for this and then be on guard. No. We are instructed to be on guard when? When? Now. Now. That is why we were not concerned that Christ might come during the blood moon time any more than we were before or after that. We are always to be on guard. A number of people have said to me, I think it is not so important what view I hold about the end time. What is important is that I am ready. But I ask you, what does Jesus tell us is the thing that keeps us ready? Is it not our watching? And I ask, what it was Jesus used to show us that we should be ready at all times? Is it not the fact that he might come at any time? Is that so? So if you hold to a view that says Jesus is coming sometime after the tribulation begins, I know one thing about you. You're not expecting him today. I know that. You can't be. And this passage says we're to be ready at all time. Jesus' illustration says that if the master of the house had known when the thief would come, he would have watched. Why is Jesus' return likened to a thief? Does it not seem a little out of keeping? His coming will be like a thief. Does it sound a little strange for Jesus to come like a thief? Why does he use this illustration? Because his coming is like a thief. And any thief that wants to stay in business more than one time knows he has to come when you don't expect him. The one thing Jesus wants us to know about his parousia is that it will be unexpected. Unexpected. What that means is that we must be ready at all times. Furthermore, we are warned to watch for his coming. It does not warn us to watch for the Antichrist. Are you with me? No, you don't. It's okay if you don't want to commit. I understand. The Bible does not warn us to wait for Antichrist. It warns us to wait for Christ. It's crucial. This is absolutely crucial. If he's coming any time after the tribulation begins, you can wait for Antichrist. You see, we are to watch for him. It is he that is coming. You see, there are no signs for a thief's coming. Are you with me? You think this stuff I'm preaching this morning is not important? This is very important. This is very important. What would you think of a thief that pinned up a notice and said, I will come in to break at your house August the 4th at 7 p.m., huh? Well, what if he sent a note and said, I'm coming in August? Well, you would wait all of August, isn't that right? You see, when a thief comes, he comes unexpectedly. That is the nature of thieves. They do not like to, or I should say, they like to stay out of prison, you know. To stay in business, they must not be caught. And to not be caught, they must come unexpected. So look at verse 44. I'm going to go back to Matthew 24, verse 44. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not expect him. Therefore, wherefore, because a thief comes at an unexpected time, therefore you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not expect him. So how are we to live in light of this? How should we live in 2011 in light of this? Well, we say, you know what? It doesn't really look like Christ will come today yet, does it? Doesn't really look like he's going to come tomorrow, but I better be ready today because Jesus said that's the kind of time he's coming. You follow? We are to be ready at all times. I am told by the Lord Jesus himself, I am coming when you do not expect me, therefore be ready. Well, Jesus said this. And so let me close with a little story. It took place at the beginning of World War I on August the 1st, 1914. Sir Ernest Shackleton left East India docks from England on an expedition to reach the South Pole. How many have read or seen the story of Sir Ernest Shackleton? Okay, a number of you. I have been challenged by this story many times. So they set out on August the 1st, 1914. By Christmas Day, 1914, they were in heavy ice packs in the Weddell Sea. 6 months after leaving home on January the 18th, 1915, their ship was frozen stuck in the ocean in the north. For 9 long months, they remained in the ship, frozen in the ice. Over a year after they left home, they were finally forced to leave the ship because it was breaking up from the frost and the ice, and it was too dangerous to stay in it any longer. Then in another month, the ship broke up from the frost and slipped to the bottom of the Weddell Sea. They had kept 3 lifeboats, which they pulled over the ice for some time as they tried to make for land. And then in April 1916, almost 2 years after they left, the ice broke up and once more they were afloat, only this time 27 men in 3 small lifeboats. After a few days of sailing in the lifeboats in the iceberg-infested sea with huge swells and high winds, they reached Elephant Island. The rock walls were so steep and the winds so strong that they had a very hard time even getting to shore or finding a place where they could put ashore. And there they regained some strength, eating seals and penguins. And on April the 24th, Sir Ernest Shackleton left Elephant Island in a lifeboat which they had prepared for some of the most dangerous water on earth. Just this small little lifeboat. The chance of coming back were pretty well zero, I would say. So I've written here, the odds of reaching King Haakon Bay, their destination, where the Stromsnes whaling station was still in operation, were almost insurmountable. But on May the 21st, bedraggled and hardly enough strength to even walk and no supplies left, they arrived at the whaling station. The very next day, Shackleton set out to secure a boat to rescue the 21 other men of his team from Elephant Island. 3 times Shackleton set out in borrowed ships only to be beaten back by the angry ice packs. For the stranded men on Elephant Island, the hopes of rescue were dying. They had expected a rescue team could arrive within a month or so after Shackleton left. That was April, and it is now August. 2 years had gone by since they left home. On August the 17th, one diary reads, "The ice has put in a reappearance." The ice is back. On August the 18th, Green Street, one of the waiting men records, both bays are full of pack ice and the heavy pack ice as far as the eye can see. On August the 19th, Lees records, there is no good in deceiving ourselves any longer. Now, I'll tell you what. I think at that point, they are where we are in the church today. We have given up on the return of Christ. Oh, I say, oh no. Oh, yes, we have. Oh, yes, we have. You listen to how many pulpits you will hear this message from. You will be hard-pressed to find this message. We have grown silent for the year. We have almost given up. In our Mennonite circles, we care more now about saving this earth than Christ's return. Listen, we must be awake to what is going on. And I think we are where these men were. It's just a matter of time. We won't make this. Then on August the 25th, over 2 years after they left England, after three failed attempts, Shackleton was able to secure another ship, the Yelcho, a Chilean ship. It was made of steel, not good for ice, and he promised not to take the boat into ice. 5 days later, Worsley, who had been their navigator all the way, writes, 5:25 a.m., full speed, 11:10, base of land faintly visible. Threading our way between lumps of ice, reefs, and grounded bergs. 1:10 p.m., sight the camp to the southwest. On this day, which started nice and clear in the morning, but which had now turned ugly, each man has made his way up the hill to see if a ship has come. So here's the 21 people all making their way, checking to see, is the boat there, having pretty well given up, they still do this. Of course, they did not expect one and were no longer disappointed when they did not see one. At noon, one of the men, Marston, went to do some thumbnail sketches, and there in the bay was Shackleton's boat. Just like that. Back at camp, the men were having lunch and heard Marston coming on the run. They thought it was because he was late for boiled seal backbone, one of their delicacies. Then he opened the flap and said in a breathless voice, hadn't we better send up some smoke signals? It took a moment for the men to catch on, and when they did, they all caught it at the same time, and they literally tore their humble makeshift door off their abode, shredding it as they left the tent. The excitement on shore was indescribable. They say these grown, unkempt men giggled like little kids when they were outside. One of the accounts of this story says that Shackleton asked them, "How were you ready so quickly?" And these stranded sailors told him that every morning their leader rolled up his sleeping bag saying, "Get your things ready, boys, the boss may be here today." The return of the Lord is much more certain than Shackleton's return. You can count on it. And to not be ready is of much greater consequence. You see, for Shackleton's men stranded on Elephant Island, at such a time as they thought not, Shackleton returned. That is how it will be when Jesus comes. I wish I were eloquent. There's enough in here that tells us about Christ's return that we would describe one of the most glorious moments ever to happen on earth, when Jesus comes. And I want to ask you something, church. Are we going to sleep in too? Will we fall silent on the return of Christ, His imminent return, because there's opposition? Or will we believe and preach this word? What are we going to do? I want to tell you. This year, we need to be ready for Him. He could be here today. And may God guide through His word to keep us awake.